Welcome back to a retrospective of Background Briefing's coverage of the Russia-Trump story. And let's now go to a broadcast from November the 19th, 2017. And joining us now is Luke Harding, who's a journalist, writer, and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy, and The Liar, The Fall of Jonathan Aitken. Two have been made into Hollywood movies, and his latest book just out is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luke Harding.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, your book is certainly welcome, particularly for me, because I get so much hate mail from the left saying that, you know, criticizing Putin and tying the Trump campaign to Putin is the reincarnation of the Cold Warrior, and where's the proof, where's the evidence? And then, so you have denial on the left with The Nation, for example, apologists for Putin. And then on the right, you've got all these former Cold Warriors and Red Scare mongers now making excuses for Putin. So it's a peculiar political landscape, wouldn't you admit?
Well, I mean, I think it is. I mean, what I've tried to do in this book was to be basically empirical and to set what happened in 2016 in the U.S., where the Kremlin hacked the election, in a kind of broader context and really a tradition of espionage stretching back to the Soviet Union in the days of the Cold War. I mean, there's nothing kind of sort of invented or political about that. I mean, it really is a fact. And I think to understand what's been happening, you need to look at kind of classic KGB tricks, techniques, protocols of subversion, of influence, of what Russian spies used to call active measures. Because really what's been happening, I think, is this stuff, which Vladimir Putin himself learned about at spy school in the 1970s, but just updated for the age of Facebook and Twitter.
But it also seems to be a lot to do with Putin himself, doesn't it, in the sense that he seems to be obsessed with tearing down America, but not necessarily building up Russia. And indeed, him and the Siloviki are looting Russia. So is this Cold War KGB notion of Glavny Protivnik, the main enemy, is that how Putin's worldview is framed?
Yeah, I spent, as you said in your introduction, I spent 4 years in Moscow as the kind of Guardian's bureau chief between 2007 and 2011. And I think one of the sort of striking features about that was how much of the kind of methodology of the Cold War was back with Putin in charge. I mean, he was sort of prime minister for some of the time that I was there. And then, of course, has become kind of president again and has basically been running Russia for 17 years. And his worldview is unambiguously that of someone who kind of grew up in the Cold War, in the Soviet Union. He believes essentially that Russia is surrounded by hostile enemies in the West, and NATO in particular. He does genuinely believe that the United States is seeking to actively overthrow him. And it's a kind of paranoid and conspiratorial worldview where whenever, for example, there's an anti-government demonstration in Moscow, of the kind I used to cover all the time when I was a reporter there, he sort of believes, or he chooses to believe, that this is the work of the CIA, that these are not actually ordinary citizens who are fed up with corruption in Russia or misgovernment, that this is part of a kind of plot against him. And I think in part that explains what happened last year. And for him, Putin wasn't doing anything especially aggressive. He was merely repaying the United States what he thinks the U.S. has done to Russia over a very long period.
Well, let's turn to your book, Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House, which I mentioned in the opening is extremely welcome because so much hate mail says, where's the proof? Where's the proof? And I think, my God, what what more do you need? Every day another shoe drops. But my understanding is, just in terms of Putin's having this mythology as being this clever KGB spy who's running this country that is militarily powerful, but its economy, I think, is round about Canada's GDP. But he I'm not sure that that reputation is entirely well earned, because I think the cleverest people in the KGB tended to be sent to London, New York, and NATO capitals, not certainly languishing in East Germany. And much of what has happened, I think, in terms of the getting involved in influencing and manipulating the American election, my understanding is that some of the more seasoned people that he's brought into his administration, like his chief of staff, Ivanov, who was a former KGB general, they cautioned him against it. And the sort of the Young Turks jumped on it. The GRU and the FSB embraced it. I know there's a kind of competition between the two, which Putin encourages. But my understanding is the SVR were pretty skeptical about it, and they predicted some of the blowback. And my sense is that Putin's been too clever. I mean, this is...
Well, I mean that's a kind of... It's a sort of fascinating topic. And peering into kind of Russian elite politics and the differences or disagreements within the Kremlin is always very difficult, because it's such an opaque institution. And certainly the kind of art of Kremlinology, if you like, trying to kind of interpret what's going on inside Russian power is very definitely been back. It's been back for some time. I think in some respects we now know less about the inside goings-on of the Putin regime than we did at the Soviet Union, where there were kind of clues in Pravda which told you which way the wind was blowing. But if you believe the Christopher Steele dossier, which I broadly, with some caveats, I broadly do, then yeah, there was disagreement with the Russian foreign ministry and, for example, Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak, actually saying, look, this hyper-aggressive move against the United States to interfere so blatantly in the election will backfire. And those sort of more moderate voices, if you can call them that, were overruled by Putin and a kind of hardline faction around him and by the presidential administration, and who said, no, full steam ahead. So we saw these kind of disagreements. And I think the problem for Putin, Putin is actually now in a somewhat kind of paradoxical situation, because on the one hand, you might consider the fact that Trump is in power, that Hillary Clinton lost, as being really kind of arguably the kind of greatest Russian espionage operation ever, which is not to say that Trump owes his place in the White House solely to Putin. Of course not. I mean, millions of people voted for him. But undoubtedly, the emails hacked by the Kremlin and distributed via WikiLeaks helped Trump and hurt Hillary. So, I mean, that's all kind of great. But on the other hand, Putin's primary goal, I think, was to get the U.S. to lift sanctions, and they very much hoped that Donald Trump would do that. But what the Kremlin isn't so good at is it's not very good at understanding American institutional politics. And the problem is this scandal, whether you call it Russiagate or Kremlingate or whatever, has grown so enormous that it's now impossible for Trump domestically to lift sanctions, even though I think he would very much like to do so.
So, but is there a default position, in as much as the assumption is that he hated Hillary and wanted to hurt her, but he was a realist, like everybody over here, for example, thought she was going to win. So why did he think Trump was going to win? Or is Trump's victory a bonus? Or is the real bonus at the end of the day just that this whole situation is weakening America?
Well, I think Putin was generally surprised that Trump won. I think the game plan was to damage and kind of blow the legs off Hillary, if you like. They thought that Hillary would win, but she would be a weakened president. And actually, the strategy, the hashtags that the kind of Kremlin trolls had prepared was to suggest that Hillary had cheated, that the election wasn't fair, that it was illegitimate in some way. And of course, that plan was hastily abandoned when Trump crept across the line and won despite losing the popular vote. So I don't think they counted on Trump winning, and it presented all sorts of opportunities for them. Trump is still very nice about Putin. Most recently we've seen that on his Asian tour, extraordinarily. But the sanctions are kind of still in place, and I think we'll be there for some time.
So let's turn then to one of the main characters in your book, and that, of course, is Christopher Steele, who you met with. I know that all of the committees looking into this, both at the House, Senate, and Mueller. I don't know whether or not Mueller's met with him or not. I know Comey met with him. So walk us through that process, starting with John McCain and then his emissary to the UK, and how Comey got involved.
Well, I mean, some of this is known. Some of this is new, kind of, you know, that I've kind of pieced together from having talked to friends of Steele. Essentially, I met him in December 2016 before the dossier came out. He didn't say anything about the dossier, although I had kind of heard rumors of his existence and some of his kind of allegations. And when BuzzFeed published the dossier in January, and it was said that it had been authored by a former British intelligence officer, it seemed pretty clear that it was going to be Steele, and his identity was kind of confirmed a couple of days later. And, I mean, essentially, what was happening was, I think, that there were two streams of information which were going to the FBI in 2016 about contacts between people in the Trump camp and Russians. One stream was Steele, who was commissioned by Fusion GPS to kind of investigate, had no idea who the client was, but sent out this query to sources that he'd used in the past and whom he thought were credible and had a good kind of reporting track record. Now, they came back to him and were saying hair-raising things. They were saying that there were meetings going on, that there was kind of coordination, that the Trump team essentially knew, not only knew about kind of the Hillary's emails being hacked or the Democratic Party emails being hacked, but had secretly kind of co-paid for this operation. So that was one stream of alarming intelligence, which was going to the FBI, certainly from the summer of 2016 onwards. And meanwhile, I think what's kind of fascinating about this story was that European spy agencies, the British eavesdropping centre GCHQ, but also, I'm told, the French and the Germans were also picking up some very unusual things, that they routinely monitor Russian intelligence officers. And they found these people meeting with Trump people. And this information was also kind of fed back to the CIA. And so what I was told is that the American intelligence community was slow in getting their heads around this. Asleep, almost, was the word that I was told. And so we had the explosion of these Democratic Party emails, but actually the more sensational and alarming stuff was all about Trump and who his people were meeting. And then eventually, if you kind of fast forward, that the dossier ends up being given to Senator McCain in November of last year via essentially a kind of intermediary, a former British ambassador to Russia. And then McCain, in turn, seeks a meeting with James Comey. But what you have to bear in mind is that, of course, Comey had been aware of these allegations and had actually been, you know, begun an interagency investigation in summer of last year. But, of course, by this point, it's too late and Trump is president.
Right, but didn't Steele himself get impatient that he felt Comey wasn't doing anything with it? My sense is that it is pretty hard to get your head around why Obama didn't make more of an issue of it. And Hillary Clinton herself apparently believes that she was let down by her own people, that had she learned about the full scope of Russian active measures against her, she would have gone public and raised hell.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's right. That's right. I mean, my understanding is that Steele was really kind of sort of frustrated because he was engaging with the FBI and that they were reading copies of his memos, and they said, well, look, we can't possibly interfere because this concerns a presidential candidate. And I think, you know, I'm told that the relationship between Steele and the FBI essentially broke down when Comey announced 10 days before polling day that he was reinvestigating Hillary's emails. Because, you know, of course this was affecting one presidential candidate and not the other. And I've also talked to sort of senior people inside the Obama administration who kind of went through a period of soul-searching, that they could have done more. And they didn't, I think largely because they thought that Hillary would win and that Trump would absolutely be enraged and try and kind of exploit this to his advantage if the Obama administration had complained, you know, and cried foul over Russia.
Well, that goes back to your point earlier, though, that the Kremlin didn't expect him to win, but they wanted to make life miserable for her. And I imagine Trump would have spent the next 4 years of an Hillary presidency running around the country saying, lock her up, lock her up.
And also saying that the election was stolen from him.
Yeah, exactly.
That Hillary had cheated, that she wasn't legitimate, that she was fake and so on and so on and so on. And so this is the scenario they were trying to avoid. And meanwhile, of course, Trump crept across the line.
Mm. Well, the recent revelations about connections between or correspondence between Donald Trump Jr. and Julian Assange, what was most disturbing about those Twitter exchanges that were revealed by The Atlantic is the kind of unctuous nature of and the kind of giddy sense that Assange has of almost being like a Rupert Murdoch, a kingmaker. Here he is offering advice.
Well, I mean, he wanted to be ambassador to Australia. Yeah, Australian right. ambassador to the U.S. That was his kind of fantasy.
Well, that is beyond a fantasy. I mean, but nevertheless, the idea that he's giving advice and that he sees himself as this powerful player on the world stage, it's pretty heady stuff, isn't it?
Well, right. Although at the same time, I mean, he's a world famous individual. He's got 4 million plus followers on Twitter, and actually, whether you like him or not, you have to acknowledge that the material that he's published, these Democratic emails, have probably changed or at least tilted the course of history. But he's not modest. Let's leave it at that.
Right. Well, but that's what's so bizarre is that he's kind of a hero of the left, and yet he's helped the most right wing president in American history, perhaps.
Well, I mean, I would agree with that, but I think Julian won't agree with this. But I mean, I think the problem is that he sort of sees the world through the lens of who is for him, Julian Assange, and who is against him. And of course, he hates Hillary, and he believes that she's out to get him, and therefore he likes Russia, who were also kind of seeking to destroy her. And so there's a kind of commonality there.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I really appreciate your book. It's extremely important and extremely timely. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Luke Harding, who's a journalist, writer, and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy, and The Liar, The Fall of Jonathan Aitken. Two have been made into Hollywood movies, and his latest book just out is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. And that was from Background Briefing's November 19th broadcast. This has been a retrospective of Background Briefing 2017 coverage of the Trump-Russia story. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.